Russia's resurgence. Russia's changed since the fall of the Soviet Union. After a shaky start, capitalism is thriving. From bankruptcy in the early 90s, Russia is now one of the world's top economies. And President Putin is reaping political benefits from this prosperity. After 8 years in office, he's as popular as ever. He's been using his strong position at home to extend Russia's influence abroad. After butting heads with President Bush over missile defense in Eastern Europe and nuclear power in Iran, ties between the U.S. and Russia today are strained. In the hour ahead, we'll explore U.S.-Russia relations since the end of the Cold War, and we'll look at how NATO expansion complicated that relationship from the beginning. But we start our program with a look at the political situation inside the country. Russia's been experiencing an economic boom, but democracy is in recession. In the last few years, Putin has consolidated his power. He's effectively quashed all political opposition by tightening restrictions on electoral laws and cracking down on civil society. In national elections December 2nd, Putin's United Russia Party won three-quarters of the Duma's 450 parliamentary seats. Those elections were marred by allegations of voter intimidation and fraud and were deemed not fair by international election observers. One statistic that does seem to hold up is Putin's personal approval rating. Around 70% of Russians think he's doing a good job. We went to Moscow to see why Russians still support their president despite his ever tighter reign over the country.
American Public Radio.
And теперь по-русски.
Американское общественное радио.
Замечательно. Это выключите, пожалуйста.
Switch it off, please.
You hear that a lot in Russia. Cameras and tape recorders are still viewed with Soviet-era suspicion. And while it can be annoying for a visitor, the problems faced by Russian journalists obviously run much deeper, and they reflect a crisis in Russia's once promising democratic transition. Russia is the world's third most dangerous country for journalists, after Iraq and Colombia. That's according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. 43 Russian journalists have been killed in direct relation to their work since 1993. The best known of those slain reporters was Anna Politkovskaya.
Much honored Russian journalist Anna Politkovskaya was shot to death today in Moscow. She was 48, known for her critical coverage of Russia's role in
Yulia Latinina was a colleague of Politkovskaya's at the Moscow-based Novaya Gazeta newspaper. She also hosts a weekly program on Echo Moskvy, an independent liberal radio station.
The regimes, they are not divided into democracies and the regimes that are not democracies. They are divided into the regimes where people are killed for opposition and where they are not killed. And before Politkovskaya's murder, we were in the first category, and now we're in the second.
Under Putin, Russia's national TV networks have been shut down or brought under Kremlin control. But the country still boasts over 400 daily newspapers.
There should be no illusion that Russian population, you know, they're just guys who are kept in the darkness because of official propaganda. You know, after all, everybody who wants to know something, he can look in the internet, he can read newspapers.
And according to Masha Lipman, people do know what's going on. She's a political analyst with the Carnegie Moscow Center.
I think people are not stupid. They see television is tightly controlled. They see the way the Kremlin masterminds political parties and scraps others and then merges parties together to its taste and then bars the way to unwelcome politicians to the political scene. People see all this.
And yet, strikingly, over two-thirds of the population would like to see Putin remain in office. He even has a hit song named after him, A Man Like Putin.
Putin is a separate thing. As the superior ruler, he's regarded as the embodiment of the Russian statehood. Putin's rating is not rating in the strict sense of the word, because a rating implies a comparison, a competition of some sort. There is no alternative to Putin.
The ruling United Russia Party is also popular. Even accounting for fraud in the last election, it's estimated around 50% of people support the party. This suggests that people like what they see. Lipman says it's not that straightforward.
They may or may not like it, but even if they don't like it, the attitude to it is passive and it is cynical. I think it is assumed that nothing depends on us. It is us below versus them up there. And people do not expect this to be otherwise because they accept it. They don't want to get active. They don't believe in activism, especially since things are better for many people in Russia today.
And economically, things are much better for many Russians. Roland Nash is chief strategist for Renaissance Capital, the largest investment bank in the former Soviet Union.
From a purely economic growth perspective, Russia is absolutely booming. 8 years ago, the entire Russian economy was about $200 billion. Today, it's about $1.2 trillion. Put that into perspective, in 1999, the entire Russian economy was worth less than the U.S. government budget surplus. Now, the Russian economy is one of the top 10 in the world, and the rates of growth are phenomenal.
Much of that growth is due to rising oil and gas prices. Russia is the world's largest oil producer. It also has the world's largest known natural gas reserves. In 2006, oil and gas accounted for close to 65% of the country's exports. Following the chaotic Yeltsin years and the economic crisis of 1998, Nash says Putin has done a lot to encourage investment in Russia. This year, Russia will see about $30 billion in foreign direct investment.
The really important thing that Putin has brought to the Russian economy is stability. You cannot do business unless you know that the rules today are going to be similar to the rules in 3 or 4 years' time. And before Putin, there just wasn't any stability.
And while the rules stay the same, there's still the Kremlin's rules.
The way in which the Kremlin looks at the economy is very much in two parts. There is the strategic parts of the economy, and then there's everything else. So in those sectors, the Kremlin's been very obvious in saying, you know, you come into these sectors, you have to play by our rules, and they're not necessarily the market rules.
The strategic sectors are the politically sensitive sectors, usually oil, gas, mining, and defense. But in the lead-up to December's parliamentary elections, Putin also introduced controls on food prices. Worried that rising prices could have an impact at the polls, he asked food producers to freeze the cost of basic foodstuffs like bread and milk at their October prices. This measure is the latest example of how, despite his sky-high approval ratings, Putin isn't taking any chances. Revolutions in the neighboring former Soviet states of Georgia and Ukraine prompted Putin to strengthen government controls over civil society. Masha Lipman of the Carnegie Moscow Center.
This was received as a lesson by the Kremlin that by all means we should bar the way to anything like Orange Revolution in our country. And it was back then, in late 2004, early 2005, when the government began to crack down on anything that could create potential autonomy for political or public players.
Another important lesson the Kremlin has learned was that young people can wield a lot of power. Alexander is a member of the pro-Putin youth group, Nashi. Its name means ours, or our guys. He spoke to us at a rally in Moscow.
Наше movement is an anti-revolution movement. It was created specially to prevent revolution like happened in Ukraine, Orange Revolution. It wasn't a military coup, it was people's revolution. And we are trying to prevent the same scenario in Russia.
There's no official Kremlin connection to the organization, but it's commonly acknowledged that Nashi is the brainchild of Putin's deputy chief of staff, Vladislav Surkov. Listening to pro-Putin rap songs, their signature red jackets and flags stand out against the gray Moscow sky. Nashi describes itself as a democratic, anti-fascist youth movement, but its aggressive pro-Russia manifesto, together with an emphasis on healthy living and procreating for the good of the country, has brought comparisons with the Hitler Youth. Nashi is the most visible example of Russia's growing nationalism. And this nationalism can manifest itself in ugly ways. Amnesty International has described violent racism in the country as out of control. Guillaume is a chef at an American restaurant in the city. Originally from Cameroon in West Africa, he says he won't take the metro after dark because of the skinheads who patrol the stations.
They were walking with their boots in the metro station looking for people to beat up. Not only the Africans, the Armenians, the Chechens, any person that looks black, you know. Some people need it to prove that, oh, we are real Russians, we're fighting for our country, we don't let foreigners come to our country.
The government has enacted anti-extremist legislation and claims to be cracking down on race crimes. But in the international arena, nationalism is still popular. Putin's assertive foreign policy has won him a lot of points at home. Ludmila Alexeyeva has been a human rights activist for over 30 years. She's the chair of the Moscow-Helsinki group.
During several centuries, Russia was imperium. Everybody afraid us. For us, when we stopped to be Soviet imperium, we lose this proud recognition for majority. And for that reason, for us to be democratic country, to begin to raise our democracy is much more difficult than, for example, for Ukraine or for Estonia, because they are happy now they are independent.
In other words, says Masha Lipman, the Russian people are willing to accept the trade-off between a strong state and a free society.
I think the public is fully reconciled to the paternalistic pattern. The relation between government and society is that of a non-participation pact, if you like. And the public accepts this deal, especially since living standards are much better today.
And the Kremlin has a name for this deal. It's known as sovereign democracy. Masha Lipman.
The message, the rhetoric of the Russian government is that what having it the Russian way is having it a democratic way. And if in the West they don't think this is democracy, they're fault. We think of it as democracy, and we want our democracy to be our way, not somebody else's way.
Russia's citizens seem to be content with their kind of democracy for now. But if fuel prices drop, the economy could falter, and Putin's second presidential term is up in May. While he's constitutionally barred from standing in the next election, he's made it clear he's not ready to leave the political scene. But it's not clear in what capacity he'll stay on. And even a man like Putin might find it difficult to retain his authority with someone else in the presidency. Coming up after the break, a look at the U.S.-Russia relationship since the fall of the Soviet Union.
All the Russians saw was, we're weak, you're taking advantage of us. That's the way they looked at what the U.S. was doing.
I'm Ray Suarez. You're listening to From Cold War to Cold Peace, from America Abroad. I'm Ray Suarez, and this is America Abroad. On this episode of the program, From Cold War to Cold Peace, Russia's Resurgence. For 40 years following World War II, one conflict dominated the globe. It was a cold war between two competing ideologies. But when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, the Russian Federation that emerged from its ruins was racked by political and economic instability, and it had lost its status as a global superpower. Andrea Koppel takes us through Russia's struggle to find its footing and climb back as a major power in a world dominated by the United States.
It was 1985, and Mikhail Gorbachev had just come to power. In an attempt to reverse the Soviet decline, Gorbachev surprised many in the West by launching economic reforms. James Goldgeier is a professor of political science at the George Washington University.
They needed perestroika, a restructuring of the economy. The problem for Gorbachev was that to carry out a restructuring, he had to convince his own population that a system wasn't working after decades of having told people how great the system was. So in order to shed light on how bad the system was, he had to introduce what he called glasnost, openness.
Gorbachev's reforms led to an explosion of political unrest, further economic decline, and an outpouring of nationalism in Russia and throughout the Soviet Union. And in 1991, it also led to historic free elections in which Russians selected Boris Yeltsin as president. A former Communist Party chief, Yeltsin called for national independence, market capitalism, and multi-party elections in place of Soviet rule.
Boris Yeltsin, the brash populist, the man who would be president, was mobbed as he made his way to the polls today. "I hope for victory," he said, "but I'm no astrologer." But you didn't need to read the tea leaves to see which way this one was going. "We voted for Yeltsin," Galina says. "He has our trust." "It must be Yeltsin," says Oleg. "There's no other choice."
In December of 1991, Yeltsin met with the presidents of Belarus and Ukraine. By the time that meeting was finished, so too was the Soviet Union.
Tonight, the Kremlin's red flag was lowered for the last time. "People in this country," said Mr. Gorbachev, "are ceasing to become citizens of a great power."
The failure of this 75-year communist experiment was a tremendous blow to the psyche of the Russian people. And even though Russia's new leader, Boris Yeltsin, supported democratic reforms, he was still a wild card with a checkered past. In 1989, before Yeltsin was elected president of Russia, he visited the United States and showed up at the White House drunk for a meeting with National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft. James Goldgeier.
What happens is that Yeltsin's very upset. He expects to have a meeting, a formal meeting with George Bush in the Oval Office, and that's not what's happening. And so he makes a big scene and gets very angry. And Scowcroft can't believe that this drunk guy showed up at the White House. And so they're not feeling very positive toward Boris Yeltsin.
All that changed in 1993 when President Bill Clinton came into office. Clinton embraced Yeltsin and made supporting democracy in Russia a central goal of his foreign policy. Only 3 months later, after his inauguration, Clinton made it a priority to meet with Yeltsin and pledge support for his Russian counterpart.
"Mr. President, our nation will not stand on the sidelines when it comes to democracy and Russia. We know where we stand. We are with Russian democracy. We are with Russian reforms. We are with Russian markets. We actively support reform and reformers and you in Russia."
In September 1993, Yeltsin engaged in a power struggle with the conservative Russian parliament over his demand they draft a new constitution. When no agreement was reached and with threats from parliament to impeach him, Yeltsin unilaterally dissolved the parliament, a move he later admitted was unconstitutional. A furious parliament responded by electing a president to replace Yeltsin, and many parliamentarians barricaded themselves in the Russian White House, then the seat of the parliament.
Armed anti-Yeltsin hardliners led by diehard communists routed police and interior ministry troops in Moscow today, dealing a major blow to Boris Yeltsin's power. At the Kremlin, Yeltsin declared a state of emergency and ordered elite army forces into the city.
Yeltsin ordered the Russian military to open fire on the rebellious Congress. Order was eventually restored, but the damage was already done. Yeltsin's decision to use force against Russian citizens proved a serious blow to him and to Russian democracy. Only a year later, Yeltsin commanded the army to crush resistance in the breakaway Republic of Chechnya.
"Russian troops have advanced to within 100 yards of the all-but-destroyed presidential palace in the Chechen capital, Grozny. Thousands of refugees have fled the battered capital and are sheltering in nearby villages and forests."
In Washington, the Clinton administration continued to back Yeltsin in the face of widespread human rights abuses by the Russian military. Despite his bluster, Yeltsin was still cooperating with the U.S. on many important foreign policy issues.
But one of the Clinton administration's most important post-Cold War goals was making sure that the countries of Eastern Europe were firmly anchored in the West. That meant expanding NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. James Goldgeier.
All the Russians see is they have contracted their own position in Europe. They've moved back from controlling Eastern Europe, countries of the Warsaw Pact, the Baltic countries, Ukraine. And wait a minute, the United States is going to take its Cold War alliance and start moving into that area? Well, the Russians are absolutely apoplectic about this whole thing. But Bill Clinton, he's a very charming guy, and he believes that he can just explain to Boris Yeltsin that it's not about Russia, it's not directed against Russia, and he can help bring Russia closer.
But even with President Clinton's charm, the Russian statesman never warmed to the idea of NATO expansion.
All the Russians saw was, we're weak, you're taking advantage of us. That's the way they looked at what the U.S. was doing.
In 1996, Yeltsin faced an uphill battle for re-election, and even though he persevered to secure a second term as president, his power quickly began to wane. That was partly due to a shaky Russian economy that eventually collapsed during the winter of 1998.
Since the end of August, Muscovites have seen their financial security collapse as the ruble tumbled, prices soared, and banks ran out of money. Inflation rose 35% in 1 week.
Yeltsin's other problem that winter was that Serbia, Russia's longtime ally, was involved in fighting ethnic Albanians in Kosovo in what NATO believed was a campaign of ethnic cleansing. Russia threatened to block any United Nations resolution that would use force to stop Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic. The solution? NATO decided to launch airstrikes against Serbia without the approval of the UN. That decision wasn't well received in Russia.
Anti-American sentiment here has been building and took a violent turn yesterday when a carload of gunmen tried to launch a rocket-propelled grenade at the U.S. Embassy.
The U.S.-Russian ties that President Clinton had worked so hard to cultivate were fraying. Within a year, Boris Yeltsin's failing health would force him to leave office. His hand-picked successor was a relatively unknown former KGB agent named Putin. Putin spoke of rebuilding Russia's international standing and rapidly gained popularity across the country. James Goldgeier.
The popularity really stemmed from what he wasn't, which was Yeltsin. I mean, the problem was Yeltsin had presided over an era in which Russia seemed to be in decline. There was tremendous chaos. The economy had done very poorly. And you have in Putin, you have somebody who's very young, seems to have a lot, you know, he's got a lot of energy. And what he promises is he's going to restore stability to Russia. He's going to try to focus on economic growth and to bring Russia back as a great power.
Rising oil prices soon helped put the Russian economy back on track. Meanwhile, the newly elected Putin began to roll back some of the freedoms enjoyed under Yeltsin. Nevertheless, the relationship between the newly elected U.S. President George W. Bush and Vladimir Putin got off to a strong start.
I looked the man in the eye. I found him to be very straightforward and trustworthy. I was able to get a sense of his soul. He's a man deeply committed to his country and the best interests of his country. There was no kind of diplomatic chit-chat trying to throw each other off balance. There was a straightforward dialogue, and that's the beginning of a very constructive relationship.
But this new cooperation didn't last long. Russia has complicated U.S. efforts to halt Iran's nuclear ambitions and has protested the installation of a future American missile defense system in Eastern Europe. Inside Russia, Putin stepped up his crackdown on civil society. While the Bush administration has been critical of these changes, it also believes that cooperating with Russia is important.
When it comes to confronting real threats such as nuclear proliferation or the threat of radicalism and extremism, Russia is a good, solid partner.
But experts believe with Russia's growing sense of confidence at home and abroad, Moscow might not want or need the U.S. to be such a solid partner. James Goldgeier.
And what you have in the years since Putin's come to power is this sense that, wait a minute, Russia is now back. It doesn't need Western help the way it did in the 1990s. It's not a superpower the way it was before, but it certainly has reasserted itself. And it's not going to do things just because the United States says, look, you really ought to do that and it's really important to us. The Russians are going to make their own calculations about what's important.
I'm Andrea Koppel for America Abroad.
I'm Ray Suarez, and this is America Abroad. During the 1990s, the Clinton administration was faced with a difficult dilemma: how to expand the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, without upsetting relations with the young and fragile democracy in Russia. In our Eyewitness segment, Garrick Utley looks back at how and why American policymakers spent years carefully walking the NATO-Russia tightrope.
When President Clinton entered office in 1993, his administration had to answer an important question. For over 40 years, NATO had been the premier Western alliance, designed to deter the Soviet Union from attacking the democracies of Western Europe. But with the Cold War over, was NATO needed?
When we came into office in 1993, the question of whither NATO was very much before us.
Warren Christopher was Secretary of State during the first Clinton administration.
Would NATO go ahead as it was before, basically as an anti-Soviet entity, or would there be a new mission for NATO?
Those questions began to be answered on April 22, 1993. The dedication of the Holocaust Museum in Washington was attended by presidents of many Eastern European countries, towering figures like Václav Havel from Czechoslovakia and Lech Wałęsa from Poland, who had struggled for freedom under communist rule. Anthony Lake was the National Security Advisor for President Clinton. He recalls that these leaders had a message for the president.
But each of them emotionally, strongly, effectively argued for a NATO enlargement. And I remember sitting there listening to this and, well, first watching as the president reacted, and it clearly made a very strong impression on him, in moral terms as well as in terms of strategic interest and strategic possibility.
Warren Christopher believed that expanding NATO would help to consolidate peace and democracy throughout Eastern Europe.
We thought it was a marvelous alliance that had been so useful, but it, in a way, had gone beyond its original purpose. The president had a vision of very much wanting to unify Europe on a democratic basis, and he saw NATO as a vehicle for doing that.
But other American officials worried that expanding NATO eastwards would endanger America's relationship with Russia. Russians saw the expansion of the Western Cold War alliance as provocative and threatening. So the Pentagon came up with an alternative called the Partnership for Peace. The former Soviet satellite nations would be connected to NATO and could later become full members. Elizabeth Sherwood Randall worked at the Pentagon on Russian affairs.
This was an absolutely brilliant idea. The Partnership for Peace was not initially as threatening to the Russians because it seemed vaguer to them. It didn't have a history. Partnership for Peace was focused specifically on developing peacekeeping capabilities with all of the countries that would be joining it.
But within the Clinton administration, there was disagreement as to how the Partnership for Peace should be viewed. Anthony Lake.
And the argument largely came down whether we would proceed with NATO enlargement or whether we would use the Partnership for Peace as an alternative to NATO enlargement. And my concern very strongly was that if you did that, then you ended up with first-class citizens and second-class citizens in this larger grouping, and that it would be better to have the Partnership for Peace a kind of a way station to NATO membership.
In October 1993, the Clinton administration decided to announce the Partnership for Peace as the first step towards NATO enlargement. But the timetable for the enlargement was left uncertain. After that decision, Warren Christopher flew to Russia. He recalls meeting with Boris Yeltsin at the Russian president's hunting lodge on the outskirts of Moscow.
And when I went up to the door to enter the place, there was a very heavy odor of alcohol at that time. And then we started talking about Partnership for Peace. I was prepared to explain it to him in some detail. And before I could really lay out the way it worked, he interrupted me and said, He thought it was a stroke of genius, and I should tell President Clinton that it was a brilliant stroke. And I left there quite puzzled as to why I got such a favorable reaction. Was it because he'd not been well briefed? Had his aides not told him that this was a first step toward NATO expansion? Or was he, as we used to say in North Dakota, just having a bad day?
At the meeting, Christopher tried to make it clear to the Russians that NATO expansion would progress at a steady rate.
There was no effort to hide the fact that this was a first step, but also we were very clear that this would be gradual. There would not be any rapid expansion of NATO, that we would take our time, but that we were going to get there. Well, there was that natural tendency on people to believe what they wanted to believe. I think the Russians saw it as something that might never lead to NATO expansion.
In January 1994, President Clinton tried to dispel that notion. In a speech in Prague, he emphasized more forcefully than before that NATO expansion was moving forward.
While the partnership is not NATO membership, neither is it a permanent holding room. It changes the entire NATO dialogue so that now the question is no longer whether NATO will take on new members, but when and how.
After President Clinton's speech, the administration accelerated its push for NATO expansion. It would be the job of Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbot to manage the sensitive diplomacy with Russia.
I felt that it was important to create the reality that NATO was seriously establishing criteria for enlargement and that candidate states would in due course get in, and that due course would not be a euphemism for some distant day in the future, but that it had to proceed in a deliberate fashion and that it had to proceed in parallel with our work with Russia.
But working with the Russians did not mean giving them a veto over NATO's enlargement.
But I recognized that we must not give Russia any sense whatsoever that Moscow could hit the brakes, that Moscow could threaten to hold its breath and turn purple and jump up and down unless the process stopped, that simply wouldn't work. So there needed to be an impression that inevitably new countries were going to come into NATO.
Despite the best efforts of Talbot and others, in the winter of 1994, Russia did hold its breath, turn purple, and jump up and down. The setting was the meeting of the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe to be held in Budapest. Clinton's foreign policy team persuaded the president to make the long flight to Hungary, deliver a speech, and then head home. But at the meeting, Boris Yeltsin shocked U.S. officials with a blistering address in which he warned that NATO enlargement would cause the Cold War to be replaced by a cold peace. Alexander Vershbaugh was a senior director for European affairs at the National Security Council.
So we thought we had pre-wired a fairly successful package of agreements and meetings, and then to everybody's horror, but particularly President Clinton's, who didn't really want to make that 24-hour back-and-forth trip in the first place, to get this cold shower from Yeltsin was a little bit infuriating.
After the blow-up in Budapest, it took a big effort to get U.S.-Russian relations back on track. One important success was to get Russian troops to work side-by-side with NATO forces to enforce the Dayton Peace Accords that brought an end to violence in Bosnia. Elizabeth Sherwood-Randall.
The objective here was to give the Russians the experience of working constructively with NATO as a military organization, to create the reality on the ground that Russian soldiers and Russian commanders could experience together and that Russian political leaders could point to the Russian people, so that they could begin to see that NATO could play a positive role in post-Cold War Europe.
At the same time, the United States put the brakes on NATO enlargement in response to a disturbing development inside Russia. The Communist Party, which still existed in opposition to the government and was headed by Gennady Zhuganov, held a commanding lead in early polling for the upcoming presidential election. Strobe Talbot.
So we were constantly calibrating and recalibrating how quickly we could move the thing along. When for a long time, many, many months, it looked like Boris Yeltsin was going to be defeated by, as they say, a card-carrying communist, Mr. Zhuganov. And while we didn't want to give Russia a veto, We also did not want to give the communist candidate for the president of Russia a stick to beat Boris Yeltsin with.
When Yeltsin managed a come-from-behind victory in the summer of 1996, you could almost hear the huge sigh of relief in Washington. President Clinton now took a major step towards enlarging NATO by laying out a definitive timetable. In October 1996, he spoke in Detroit.
Today, I want to state America's goal. By 1999, NATO's 50th anniversary, and 10 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, the first group of countries we invite to join should be full-fledged members of NATO.
While resigned to NATO's expansion, Boris Yeltsin still tried to limit the growth of the alliance. Strobe Talbot recalls a meeting in March 1997 in which Yeltsin appealed to his American friend.
And he said to Bill Clinton, Bill, he said, speaking in Russian, of course, he said, let's go into a secret room and you just whisper in my ear a promise that the Baltic states will never be allowed into NATO, and then I will not worry about this and I'll never tell anybody.
Clinton was not to be persuaded.
And Clinton laughed and said, Boris, first of all, I can't do that. And second, you shouldn't want me to do that. Because if your neighbors think that you are still obsessing about them as potential enemies of yours, and that because they're part of NATO, they're going to be hostile to Russia, you're just going to drive them in that direction.
U.S. officials worked to ease Russians' fears that NATO would be directed against them. So they came up with the idea of a NATO-Russia joint council. Alexander Vershbow.
And the basic concept was we would have consultations that would kind of have Russia working with NATO, but not literally in NATO. So there wouldn't be a veto over NATO's own decisions. The idea was that then 16 members of NATO would form a common position and then try to engage with Russia on that basis.
The charter of the NATO-Russia Founding Act was signed in Paris in May 1997, and 2 months later it was announced that Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic would formally be invited to join NATO. Though the Clinton administration tried to make NATO enlargement palatable to Russia, it also made clear that the alliance would grow regardless of what Russia said or did. It was a very bitter pill for Russia to swallow. And Elizabeth Sherwood Randall says the legacy of NATO's enlargement has damaged the U.S. relationship with Russia.
I think they were resigned, ultimately, to NATO expansion, and I think we paid a price for that because, unfortunately, the decision to expand NATO at the time that we did played into the hands of those in Russia who were fundamentally opposed to cooperation with the West and who were avid nationalists who made the case that what we were doing in NATO showed that we were not serious about partnership with Russia.
But Anthony Lake believes it was right for the Clinton administration to expand NATO, and particularly when it did.
The argument we made was, look, we can't now predict where Russia will go. If you saw a Russia that was beginning to try again to dominate its neighbors, at that point, if we have not enlarged NATO, then the Poles, the Czechs, the Hungarians are going to be clamoring for the protection of NATO against a resurgent and somewhat frightening Russia. If at that point we did enlarge NATO suddenly, then we would be dramatically escalating the problems with Russia. So it was much better to do it back then and to do it in a way in which we were working with the Russians, and that's finally where it came out.
I'm Garrick Utley for America Abroad.
For transcripts of interviews with the voices in this segment, visit our website, americaabroad.org. Coming up after the break, we'll visit Serbia and Kosovo to explore Russia's foreign policy interests and actions. I'm Ray Suarez, and this is From Cold War to Cold Peace, from America Abroad.
I'm Ray Suarez, and this is America Abroad. On this episode of the program, From Cold War to Cold Peace, Russia's Resurgence. In 1999, NATO bombs rained down on Belgrade. The objective? To stop Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic's ethnic cleansing campaign. Russia opposed the NATO action in its backyard, but was powerless to stop it. President Yeltsin was ailing, Russia had a feeble economy, and a fiercely divided political leadership. Today, Russia has piles of cash. It's the world's leading oil and gas producer, and President Vladimir Putin is a street-fighting man. And while the U.S. has been tied up in Iraq, Russia has been quietly strengthening ties with Belgrade and accumulating political and financial capital in the Balkans. The U.S. supports Kosovo's desire for independence. Serbia has said it will not surrender an inch of its territory. Russia has threatened to veto any UN plan that doesn't pass muster in Belgrade. As a result, the UN talks failed, and it's just a matter of time before Kosovo unilaterally declares independence. That could set off a chain reaction of new secession movements and conflict in the Balkans. The small city of Mitrovica, Kosovo, is caught at the center of the debate. Mitrovica is where the predominantly Serbian North Kosovo meets the Albanian South Kosovo. The Ibar River runs through the city, and it could potentially become the border between Serbia and an independent Kosovo.
I'm Georgi Kakuk. I'm the political advisor of the UN regional representative here in Mitrovica. We're in the middle of Mitrovica, actually standing on the main bridge. This bridge has no name. This bridge doesn't connect, it divides. North is the Serbian part, and southern Mitrovica is inhabited by Albanians. The Serbs try to keep northern Kosovo for themselves. If they lose North Mitrovica, they lose entire northern Kosovo. And for the Albanians, it's basically a part of Kosovo. It's very symbolic because they are wishing to keep the territorial integrity of Kosovo, which includes North Mitrovica and the three other municipalities.
And the bridge has been the site of numerous conflicts between the Serbs and Albanians. Today, the bridge is the scene of a diplomatic conflict.
Russia has their very firm, perhaps someone could call a pro-Serbian position. The United States is having its own position. It's been made very, very clear by President Bush when he visited Albania. Symbolically, you can call this bridge as a kind of dividing line between Russia and United States.
The Dolce Vita Cafe sits in North Mitrovica. 18-year-old Zoran Jonakovic looks across the street at the bridge.
This is a symbol of the city. You know, symbol of terrible happens. Albanian to Serbian fighting. We don't want nothing. We just want to save our land. And we are so happy because Russia take our side. Only Putin understands us. I love him. He's so strong man, you know.
To Serbs like Zoran, Russia's underlying interests don't matter. All that matters is that Russia is an ally at a time when Serbia is looking for powerful friends. Russia's position on Kosovo plays well to the north of the Ibar River. But in the Albanian South Kosovo, it's a different story. Pristina is the capital of Kosovo. Here, business people, UN officials and local politicians mingle in the lobby of the Grand Hotel Pristina. And here, roughly 25 miles south of Mitrovica, the bridge serves as a powerful metaphor.
I think this is the new divide line between West and East, this kind of Berlin Wall of our days.
Barat Bujala is the editor of the daily newspaper Express. Like most Albanians in Kosovo, he's suspicious of Russia's motives.
They are just coming back from the disastrous years under Boris Yeltsin power. But now their interest is not allowing Serbia to join NATO and European Union. They don't care about independence of Kosovo. It was a timing to alert the world that we are back in the stage of the powers. They are just flexing muscles and coming back to the old days.
Andrei Dronov is head of the Russian Chancery in Kosovo. he bristles at the implication that Russia is seeking to return to the days of Soviet hegemony.
The Russian position is not against the Kosovo independence. Russia's position is that any solution to Kosovo conflict should be accepted by both parties. That's the only way to find a solution which would correspond to United Nations Charter and to all international legal norms.
Dronov also says that Russia is concerned about the precedent that would result from Kosovo unilaterally declaring independence. He argues that could embolden some of Russia's neighbors to seek independence and potentially destabilize the region. Andrei Dronov says that Russia is motivated by more than just precedent.
Yes, we are pursuing our national interests, which are the stability, international law, the whole system of international security. But we also take in mind our traditional, very close relations with Serbia, which cannot be disregarded in this world.
Outsiders argue that Putin's foreign policy agenda is driven as much by pride as by principle. At a thriving internet cafe at Moscow State University, students we spoke with revealed an appetite for a bolder bear.
Earlier we had a very strong country and we influenced on many decisions which were discussed in the world. And now
we think that our country should be more respected maybe in the world, and our opinion should have more weight than it has now.
I don't think that the world wants to see strong Russia as a leader, for example, in world politics.
Across Moscow sits the American-owned Starlight Diner. There we met up with Pat Davis-Simchik. She's the owner of Eurasia Energy Media and has been living and working in Moscow since the early 90s.
Russia always thinks of itself as very special. In the 90s, it was essentially felt itself beaten down, which brought out Russia's historical inferiority complex, which, you know, it always has to assert itself. I think Russia is not necessarily allying itself with any particular power. I think that's basically just to show the West that it has other options.
Quite frankly, I don't see much of a vision on the Russian side.
Dmitry Trenin is deputy director at the Carnegie Moscow Center. He's written extensively on Russian foreign policy and security issues.
The Russians know what they are against, but they do not have an impressive positive agenda. The Russians have come up with a number of nice-sounding proposals, but it's all pretty nebulous, it's all pretty vague, it's very ambitious, somewhat arrogant, but you don't get much substance behind it.
But others argue that it's not about substance per se, it's about changing the international playing field. Fyodor Lukyanov is editor-in-chief of Russia in Global Affairs, a policy journal in Moscow.
The Kosovo issue is the first case when Russia clearly demonstrates that without us, it's completely impossible to solve any significant international problem. Before Kosovo story, Russian approach was we opposed the most of Western ideas and Western solutions, but in the end of the day, Russia preferred to compromise and to accept Western models with some small changes in the initial proposal.
Now, Lukyanov says, those days are over.
From Russian point of view, it's very important to play political games, to risk maybe sometimes, because the main task of Russian foreign policy is to create better preconditions for Russian future status in the world order, which will be shaped in a couple of years from now.
The Russians are not aiming to be number one. They're not aiming to displace the United States. They want to restrict America's dominance.
Dmitry Trenin and others see this as a key point. History did not end with the fall of the Soviet Union, and Russia was humiliated by its diminished role in a unipolar international order. Trenin says that in his attempt to restructure the international balance of power, Putin is reaching back to Russia's past practice of great power politics.
When you become rich, you repay your debts, so you become independent. Then you want to get famous. And you kind of become famous by doing all sorts of things, some of them clever, some of them stupid. And when Russians sell arms to Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. They're poking in the U.S. eye and tit for tat for the U.S. support for Georgia, for example.
Experts in Washington are trying to understand the course of Russia's foreign policy today and are looking for opportunities to build trust and cooperation. But Dmitry Trenin cautions that people need to be patient.
I think that the relationship will get somewhat worse in the year or so ahead. But then I think that the new Russian leadership will be interested in establishing a working relationship with the United States. The new U.S. leadership will be interested in establishing working relationships with the major powers around the world. So I can see some points of convergence. There's no fundamental conflict between Russia and the United States, nor is there going to be one. There's a lot of bad feeling, the atmospherics are terrible, but there's no conflict.
Ultimately, it's only in the last few years that Russia has turned around its economy and is finding its way in the world again. Given questions about its long-term economic health and its political leadership, maybe a cold peace and a bridge that divides is the best that can be hoped for under the current circumstances. For America Abroad, I'm Ray Suarez. You've been listening to From Cold War to Cold Peace. For transcripts and a podcast of this program, visit us on the web at americaabroad.org. Our production team includes Ilana Weinberg, Alex Riley, and Amber Finkbinder. Our director of research is Chris Williams. Our senior producers are Sean Carberry and Hermione G. Our director of broadcasting and station relations is Steve Martin. Aaron Lobel is our executive producer. Special thanks to Paul Bogosian at CBS Radio. I'm Ray Suarez. Join me next month for another edition of America Abroad from Public Radio International.
Support for America Abroad comes from the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Corporation, the Stewart Family Foundation, the Star Foundation, the Plowshares Fund, the Hewlett Foundation, the Journal of Foreign Affairs, and from The American Interest, a magazine devoted to illuminating America's global role. Support also comes from this and other Public Radio International stations and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hi, this is Democratic presidential hopeful Dennis Kucinich, and I encourage all Americans to join the Capitol Steps for their New Year's edition of Politics Takes a Holiday. You might even hear from some of the other candidates.
McCain's campaign is plainly down the drain.
By John, she's got it! She's free!
The Capitol Steps New Year's special on this public radio station.
Today at 1 and again at 6 on WILL Urbana.
Support for today's broadcast comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, with foods from around the world, like imported chocolates, cookies, cheeses, and gift baskets, along with party catering. Also, through the holidays.